Good morning, everybody. You're listening to Right Side Up with your host, Bill Huff and Mike Taglivia, where we're talking local politics, talking about what's going on in your neighborhood. Good morning, Mike. Good
morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Hanging in there.
You know, Mike, we're amateurs at this. We tell people that all the time. We're not ashamed to admit. We've only been doing this a little bit over a year.
The only thing I'm good at is talking, so.
Well, every once in a while, I'll make a mistake. And and when I do, I'll admit it. Readily so. I'm only human. And you came to me, I guess it must have been about 2 months ago now. We were getting ready to do a show. And you had this thing, geoengineering. And I thought, why do we want to talk about whatever that thing is?
And me home with my tail between
and I didn't mean to do that.
No, that's fine.
But I thought, you know what, I didn't think it was a topic that people wanted to hear about. But since then, everywhere I go, people are talking about this geoengineering.
And state legislatures are talking about it, too.
Oh, my God, yep. So before we get too far into this, we brought in an expert today to join us on the radio show. before we go any farther, I'd like to introduce Paul Bean from Northfield. He's here to talk to us today, inform us about geoengineering. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on, guys. It's an honor to be here.
I don't know about an honor. That might be going a little bit far.
Oh, come on. Come on. It's fun to do this kind of stuff.
Well, it is a lot of fun. So, Paul, just tell us a little bit about yourself to get
started.
Sure.
My name's Paul Bean. I'm from Northfield, Vermont, born and raised here. I am 24 years old, and I ran for state senate in 2022. I unfortunately lost. Well, I lost the race. However, I won over a lot of friends and family, and I have a little bit different views than a lot of people. But to do something like that was pretty incredible. And I love Vermont. I love the environment. Obviously, I love our home state, which is so beautiful. So yeah, I mean, I don't know about expert on geoengineering.
Well, you certainly know more about it than I do.
Well,
and you showed me earlier today. You've accumulated books, textbooks, or whatever it is. You've done some research in this area, so
I have a pretty excellent team behind me too. People that have been studying it a lot longer than I have that are they've been on the ground floor of this subject for the last 60 plus years, and they've just been they're really smart guys, and they're really concerned about what we've been seeing. I mean, it's I wouldn't say that I'm the expert. The guys behind me are, but I'm definitely a good mouthpiece, and I know how to talk, so I can.
Okay. And Mike, you had some. Well, the reason you brought it up to me in the first place is we tried to talk about what's going on in New Hampshire as well,
right?
And there was actually some legislation right here in New Hampshire that proposed.
I have the article up here. This is out of Granite Rock, John Clark, 3 February 2024, and this article references House Bill 1700. The quote, Clean Atmosphere Preservation Act. And it claims the federal government is guilty of the intentional release of polluting emissions to control weather or climate. And this legislation is aimed toward that. So, and we were just talking before we started recording. Tennessee, you said, Paul?
Yeah.
There are other states. I'm sure there are at least somewhere between three and five other states that are either have passed legislation regarding this or are considering it right as we speak. So
yeah, I think Rhode Island is one of them too. They've had a bill introduced in Rhode Island. And I mean, you guys know how this stuff goes when bills get introduced, especially here in Vermont, by the way.
Yeah.
Doesn't really mean anything. But when you do have a bill introduced about geoengineering, I would argue that's kind of a big deal because it's such an obscure topic, or at least it was for the last, really forever. Like to hear that John Clark is talking about that, right? I was at, and I'm not picking on John Clark by saying this, but I was with John Clark at the Wayside, I don't know, maybe a year ago. And we were talking about some of the different subjects that you can talk about and you can maybe rush into and poke certain buttons. But he said, but when it comes to geoengineering and that whole subject, he's like, I don't go there because there's really not much he knew about it, and then not much he wanted to say because it's just such a strange subject.
Well, there's plenty of people who call it a conspiracy theory. The problem I have with conspiracy theories is all of mine have been proven true, so I need another one.
Well, let's start off by defining what it is, because, I mean, 2 months ago, I barely knew anything about it. So how would you describe geoengineering, Paul?
Geoengineering, I would describe it as a large-scale effort to manipulate the climate and or weather patterns. So, you know, there's a good example that we all kind of know of is cloud seeding, which the UAE over in Dubai, they participated in cloud seeding for at the very least that we know of the last 5 years. Let's say, I think they said in 2021 they officially announced to their government that this is something they're participating in. They're seeding the clouds to make it rain. So that's one form of geoengineering. There's also another idea/theory being tossed about by a Harvard academic named David Keith, which is where they would spray in the stratosphere, which there's not airplanes that, from what I understand, that go into the stratosphere.
Nope, that's right.
So I'm glad that we have a former airline pilot here with us. It's pretty cool, actually.
Very cool.
that's the concept is they would spray sulfuric acid into the stratosphere across the entire planet to mitigate climate change. That's his grand idea. Actually,
You're not saying that that's what's happening. Somebody is proposing something like that.
I'm not saying that's what's happening. I don't think that is a currently ongoing thing. However, I do think geoengineering is definitely ongoing, and the testing of it is absolutely happening.
I think I would agree with you there.
And that's the problem is we don't really know how much of it is happening. We just know that some of it is.
So cloud seeding has been around for some amount of time. And Mike mentioned that I've actually experienced it as a pilot. I think it was probably 15 years ago, flying into Anchorage 1 o'clock in the morning. And of course, Anchorage is right on Cook Inlet, a lot of moisture. And the visibility was below landing minimums, or would have been in Anchorage, except that they had an airplane equipped with a spraying mechanism. And the only thing he did all night long was fly approach after approach after approach. And when he got down to, normal airline type minimums, a couple hundred feet, he'd turn on whatever it was he was spraying and continue the approach down to about 50 feet over the runway and then level off, spray for a little bit, and then he'd go around and turn his mechanism off and he'd just go back and do another approach. Well, when I landed that night, I mean, absolutely fog, soup, couldn't see anything until you get to that point where cloud seeding had occurred and the visibility opened up enough to be able to land. But like I just described, he would only go so far and go around. By the time I got the airliner stopped and then off the runway, I bet I spent 20 minutes just trying to find the terminal building. Yeah, it was so foggy. So I will testify at least to the fact that in that manner, the cloud seeding that he was doing actually worked. And my understanding is what would happen is he would produce an abundance of what's called condensation nuclei.
Yes.
So it's basically dust. Water vapor suspended in the atmosphere has to have something to adhere to.
Yes.
And once you provide that thing for the vapor to adhere to, then it kind of coagulates and joins with other vapor to the point where it forms a drop. And once it forms a drop, it'll not be suspended in the atmosphere. It falls to the earth. So it takes the fog out and produces maybe a little light rain or such.
Yeah.
So, but that's very, very minor scale, small scale.
And the one thing I wanted to put into it is you're talking about at very low altitude.
Oh yeah, but there's no reason to to do it at any higher
because it won't work.
Well, it would work.
It would work,
but there's no benefit to it. I can fly the airliner on instruments not seeing anything at 1,000 feet, 500 feet, 200 feet. But but when I get down to 50 feet, I got to see something to be able to put the airliner on the ground.
Well, that
so it's a safety reason.
There are limits. Every approach has authorized landing limits in the form of visibility.
Okay.
And, some airliners now, some of the modern ones have category 3B capability, which means when you have an alert height at 50 feet, as long as all the machinery is working, the airplane will actually land itself now, and you don't need to see crap. Okay. But even so, I think the Category 3B minimums, you have to have like 300 feet of visibility.
Okay.
But when you're doing 140 miles an hour, 300 feet ain't a whole heck of a lot.
No. Yeah. It's like a blink of an eye.
Yep.
The other thing, if you're talking about, like Paul said, up in the stratosphere or in the upper atmosphere, you're spraying whatever it's suspected is being sprayed. You can't control where that stuff is going, number one.
No. Nope.
So you're not going to be able to control the weather in every place that, for instance, if we thought we were going to try to control the weather in this state or in this county, how do you do that? Because you don't know what the wind, Bill, you could probably attest to this.
Oh, yeah.
We don't know what the wind is doing, how many miles an hour the wind is at 15,000 feet.
Well, see, Mike and I were talking about this. It's kind of weird that New Hampshire would pass a law because their only jurisdiction would be the airspace over that state.
Yes, I think that's the biggest. So in the circles that I'm involved with when we're talking about this, I think it's great. If they're going to pass legislation in states, I think it's great just simply because there's more people paying attention to the subject. It doesn't mean it's going to stop anything. And ultimately, it's actually technically legal what they are doing, even the testing that they're doing, because it's not under jurisdiction of the United States Constitution or of any state's constitution. It's under the UN. That's how it's made legal necessarily. It's like a bit of background history. Let's go back a little bit in time to 1962. You have
it's more than a little bit.
Yeah, no,
it's almost my entire life.
Well, we have.
Yeah, I was born then. I know what he's talking about.
I was not around. I've just watched videos at the time. But okay, so at that time you have Lyndon Baines Johnson, who is the vice president, and he's speaking at I think it's Texas State University, and he's given a speech to these are real academic kids, they're a real genius crowd ultimately, and when one of his famous lines is, he says, "He who controls the weather will control the world." That's something he said, and he was talking about a weather satellite that would control the world's cloud layer, and that was something they were very adamant about, and not just the United States government, but governments around the world. And one of the most famous examples of weather modification and weather being used as a weapon, it's called Operation Popeye. I highly recommend anyone listening to look up Operation Popeye. It was a cloud seeding program used by the United States government during the Vietnam conflict, where they were cloud seeding over the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which is the supply line for the Viet Cong.
Right.
And the Ho Chi Minh Trail essentially would be destroyed. And what they were doing is to enhance the monsoon season. So they had tremendous rain regardless there, no matter what. But they made it even worse. And in a report, I believe it was by Gordon F. McDonald, who was one of the top environmental scientists at the time, he wrote a book, or it's not necessarily a full book, it's like 50 pages. It's called How to Wreck the Environment. And he talks a little bit about Operation Popeye in that. And basically, at that time, there was military technologies that they knew of where they could use. I mean, cloud seeding is just one example, right? But they could do a lot at that time to destroy the environment. I highly recommend looking up that too. Gordon F. McDonald, How to Wreck the Environment. And essentially what he lays out, and he's, by the way, a presidential advisor. Like, this guy was no joke. He went to Harvard. Like, he's the real deal. And he's one of the first environmentalists, actually. People would say that. He probably would be one of the first true environmentalists. And he basically said, how much time we got? Okay. He said, basically, what's so beneficial about using the weather as a weapon is it's totally cloaked and it's totally disguised. Nobody would even have a clue, because you could just attribute it to insane weather patterns. And what does that sound familiar to? What does that sound familiar?
Climate change. Ay, ay, ay.
Well.
So, I just, going back to the one thing, we can get into it in a little bit. If a neighboring state wants to do that, and whatever pollution is blowing our way, what do we do about it?
Well, I don't know.
How do you prove they've done it?
Well, we've barely scratched the surface here. So don't go away. We've got a lot more to talk about. Right Side Up. We'll be right back. Over my head. We're back with Right Side Up. We've got a special guest in the studio this morning, Paul Bean, and we're talking geoengineering. Paul, you mentioned a brochure, a pamphlet, something you were talking about.
I said it was a book or maybe a 50-page. It's about I just want to double check. It's 10 pages long, and the reason I care so much about clarifying is because it's not that long of a read. It's called How to Wreck the Environment by Gordon F. MacDonald. And I mean, this guy's—he's not a joker. He was a presidential advisor. You know, he knows his stuff. And I think it's important that people know that, you know, really since the '60s and possibly even beforehand, this has been a really big interest of governments and militaries globally.
Yeah. So this was published in the '60s.
Yes, it was. Oh, yes, yes, yeah, yes.
Wow.
But you know, just to improve on your point, we've been finding out a lot about things that were supposedly conspiracy theories, or people, you know, believed they were possible, but they didn't have proof. And we've had proof of a lot of things in these past, 5 to 10 years. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if this has been in the works.
Well, really, even since COVID, how much has come out.
Oh, right.
And that's for a lot of us. I mean, I was a little bit earlier to starting to realize a lot of this stuff, but it was post-COVID for me when I started to really say, okay, what do I think I know and what do I really know? And
I think it's for me as well. I mean, the lockdowns, I had plenty of time to do research, and that's all I did.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to just continue on that point, though, about, you know, the history of it a little bit more. You know, there's everybody wonders about how this is possible. How could this be possible? You know, it's got to be against laws. There's got to be environmental protections to you know, say the testing of this is illegal. Well, back after Operation Popeye in 1978, there was a commission on this, and it was called the Environmental. So basically what they did is there was huge public outcry saying, oh my God, this is so horrible. They were using the rain, the weather as a weapon in Vietnam. That's just too far, right? So they made a treaty, which is always great. You never know where that's going to, that seems to always work out, I guess. But they made a treaty called the Environmental Modifications Treaty, and this was created by the UN. And basically where the legality can be found in is where it says that weather modification is not to be used as a weapon. But however, it is allowed to be used for peaceful purposes and for the greater good of humanity.
So they found a workaround.
It's a loophole.
So far.
It's the loophole. And that's the big thing. It's like, it's technically legal. And I mean, all of these, it's pseudo-legality. It's just like, it's BS.
Since you know, the UN really doesn't have any authority in the United States that we don't actually give it. Okay, we have a constitution in the United States. We have a Vermont state constitution. That's what our governing documents are. And the more we keep talking about this, the more people educate themselves about the sovereignty of the U.S. The UN really doesn't have any authority.
No, it does not.
And the more people actually educate themselves to that fact, the better off we as a country will be.
So to that point, let me just say, it wasn't just LBJ talking about weather modification. JFK was talking about this when he was president.
Mm-hmm.
And basically there was another speech here he's talking about this. I don't remember where he was for this speech, but he was saying, every time you scientists come up with a new thing that is, you know, beyond just our little space, we have to figure out a way to regulate it. We have to figure out a way to internationally regulate it. And this was a big theme at the time. So I just want to tell you guys a quick story. I went to a town hall, not exactly. It was hosted by a Middlebury professor last week over in Middlebury, and it was a geoengineering conversation. And I went to it, and I went with some friends who are involved in the topic. And you know, you've been talking like, I keep hearing about geoengineering all the time. What is this geoengineering? Well, the academics are really starting to push this one version of geoengineering, where it's this idea, like, it's something that we need to possibly do, and if we don't do it, then we're all going to die because of climate change and the planet's
already...
How many
times have we heard that?
Yeah, well, yes. So I guess the reason I bring it up is because, you know, I think the guy, it was genuine. I don't think he has any nefarious intent, but the way he was presenting it was like, well, is this, these are the pros, these are the cons, is this something we should do, is it something we shouldn't do? And well, then it asks the question, you know, who can we put trust into to regulate this at a global scale? Who can regulate it at a global scale? And then some of the other people there were arguing, well, you know, I think it's a risk that we have to take and everybody has to get on board with it. It's for the greater good of for everybody. What does that sound like?
Whenever I hear that, I recoil. It's like, no.
So this conversation in Middlebury with professors wasn't about whether it exists or not.
No.
It was all about how we're going to utilize it.
Exactly. And not
there
only
was no
how,
denying it.
Well, this is...
Well, that wasn't even the purpose. Right. See, you've heard you mention that before, that you were heading to Middlebury for this thing, and I thought, oh, they're going to talk about, you know, does it exist or not exist? Well, no, I was completely wrong. I was wrong again, Mike. That's twice in one show. Twice in one show. We got to write that down.
Well, we got a former airline pilot. I mean, hey, I can't blame you for not really wanting to think much about this subject. No discredit to you. It's just, it is what it is. Like, this guy is literally saying, like, he's making the argument as if, first of all, there's a problem, which we don't even all agree on the problem, by the way, being CO2 emissions.
No.
So he's saying, this is the problem, and this is how we're going to fix it. And everybody, get in your dang EV and shut up about it.
Well, I would say we do have a problem. There isn't enough CO2. We're at the lowest levels in history that we know of, right? I exhale carbon dioxide, and all the plants that I try to grow in my garden are liking it because they use it through photosynthesis to produce the oxygen that I need. Thank you.
Well, that's just it. I mean, I could have that conversation. I think that's an entirely different podcast, by the way, or episode of the radio, because you could talk all day about what's causing our environmental issues. The main premise, though, that this guy is presenting, we're still arguing about, right?
Yeah.
And then he's saying, this is how we're going to fix it. Well, we don't even agree that there's this problem. And by the way, you're making the presumption that this isn't already going on. This is already happening, dog. I've been talking about it for 5 years. Showing up now to the conversation.
My guess is that professor already knows just as much as you. He's just not.
I don't think so. I really don't. This is another thing that I used to make the mistake of thinking, that more and more people were involved in some sort of grand conspiracy than was even possible. I don't think he has a clue. Now, Bill McKibben, on the other hand, who is an environmentalist and a big Middlebury guy, he's one of the founders of 350.org, he wrote an article in 2023 in the New Yorker about geoengineering, where something that we might just be inching towards, essentially. That was the title, something like that. And I mean, I've been watching that for a while, and I've tried to call him out for it a number of times. So Bill, if you're out there listening, you know,
well, this
stop pushing us towards geoengineering. It's a terrible idea, and it's already going on.
Well,
anyway.
It's just reeks of another experiment gone awry. Yes. At some point, we're going to find out that this is not good. It's not right. We should just leave Mother Nature alone. I mean, we have so much research, geological research, that shows us the cyclical patterns in our environment.
That's right.
Leave it alone. We can't control it. Foolish men and flesh and blood men and women think they're going to be able to control this.
Well, you know, this is, for me, what it comes down to is the same as a lot of, bring it back to local politics, it's the same as a lot of the problems that I see in Montpelier and really national politics as a whole. It's people have become so, they lack so much faith. They have zero faith, and they feel like, and I don't mean necessarily faith as in God necessarily, but they lack so much faith that they feel like they have to control everything. And that includes the weather, you know, at this point. You know, we're all going to die. What are we going to do? Oh, well, let's just create another environmental disaster, and then we'll fix that problem. I mean, I'm a strong believer. We love complicating our issues because it's easier than solving them.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Well, that we're all going to die argument.
Keeps all the politicians employed, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah.
We're all going to die argument. How many of them are going to apologize when the world doesn't come to an end?
They won't.
There'll
be another mental gymnastic.
It'll be something else. Yeah.
Look what they're doing to the kids in school. They're scaring the hell out of them.
Actually,
unnecessarily.
I'll tell you a quick story about that. When I was fourth, fifth grade, I mean, I remember being up at night, and I hate to say this because I don't want to upset anybody, like my parents, but I'd be up at night thinking, oh my God, like, what's even the point? We're all just going to die because of the climate. Today, why am I even born? You know?
Kids today are going through that same stuff.
Even worse.
Yeah.
Even worse. I was at an event up in Stowe, and I was there, and it was while I was running for office in 2022. And there was a mother there, and she was one of the hosts, and I think it was a talk about climate policy in Vermont. And they got into the conversation, the clean heat standard, and she was pressing one of the candidates, and I won't name his name, she was pressing him really hard. You know, what are you going to do when the clean heat standard comes around? Are you going to vote with the governor, or are you going to vote with the Democrats? Because this was an independent candidate. And she became very upset, and actually she started to cry because she was so upset, because she's like, my kids come home in there. And this is the thing, man. Like, I believe these people's fears are real. Like, they aren't just lying about it. Same goes for the professor that I'm telling you about in Middlebury. Like, I think he genuinely believes this stuff, and he thinks that we have to do something, you know?
I guess some of them genuinely believe it. Some of them just see it as an opportunity to take more control.
That's true, too. And like, that's why I say, like, the Bill McKibbins of the world. I can't necessarily claim. I think he sees it as an avenue to take more control. It's just, why are you being so disingenuous about this subject? Like, let's be honest about it.
So one of the oddest things I think I've ever seen, it happened a couple years ago. Senator Clarkson, Allison Clarkson,
yeah,
from Windsor County, was in a parade. And there's a kid standing, you know, a kid, 6, 7, 8 years old, something like that. And she's got a sign, you know, son. And I forget exactly what it said, but it was something about climate change and I'm going to die before I'm 20. And here's Clarkson with a big grin on her face having a picture taken with this kid. Like, oh, wait a minute, Clarkson. Yeah. She says she's going to die.
It's terrible.
You're happy about it.
Well, the whole thing just, it was odd. Very, very odd.
And they didn't.
I guess she was happy that the kid was on board. Yeah, you're right, kid. We're all going to die. I mean, it was just insane. But
yeah. I mean, when I was in school, I can remember being in kindergarten, grade school. Oh, there's going to be a mini ice age.
Yep.
Well, never happened.
Yeah.
Never happened.
I've said this before that so quickly. A couple years ago, I was on the board of a small healthcare nonprofit right here locally in Orange County. And a lot of the other board members were school nurses. And they said exactly the same thing that you just said, Paul. They saw this huge increase in the number of kids that came to the school nurse just, you know, desperate or depressed or, you know, what? Why am
fearful.
I even here? Why am I bothering?
I remember really feeling that way.
It was unbelievable.
It was terrible. And
what are we doing to these kids?
Well, why do you, to really draw back to the local politics, why do you think there's such a big pushback on all these school budgets this year? People are seeing this and they're like, what future are we setting our children up for when we're filling them up with these types of ideas? I mean, the climate thing is just one thing, by the way. I mean, we could, and that's a whole other topic, but it's just.
And they have these kids for 6 to 8 hours a day.
Right.
And so many I've taught during the campaign, me too, parents and grandparents.
Yeah.
My kids and grandkids, they don't want to go to school. They don't like school. They're afraid they're going to say something wrong and get ostracized. I mean, one little boy, a friend of mine, little boy, he said something. Somebody lost a pink cap, winter cap. Oh, it must be for a little girl. Oh, and the bus driver went nuts on this little kid. Guy pulled his kid out of school. Good for him.
I can't.
And the kids are doing better, by the way. A lot better.
If I'm ever hopeful, I'm hopeful to have kids someday, and I can tell you right now, I don't think I'd put them in a public school. And that's
I don't blame you.
It's just the way it is.
I don't blame you. It's something has to change. Look, I was in business, and if you don't provide a quality product, you go out of business, right? So,
right.
We're going to take a quick break again here. I think we got a little bit off from topic. Not that it wasn't interesting and relevant, but I think when we come back, we're going to get back onto this,
sure.
the mechanics here of geoengineering a little bit. So
how to make it rain?
I guess.
Hey, well, it's springtime.
Or
it needs to dry out a little bit.
More Right Side Up to come. Just a minute. We'll be right back.
Truth. Wrong.
You're listening to Right Side Up. My name is Mike Taglavia. My co-host is Bill Huff. We have a guest in studio today, Paul Bean. We've been talking about geoengineering. Before we get back into the conversation, I just want to remind our listeners, you can find us on WNTK.com. If you can't listen to us on the radio Saturday or Tuesday, WNTK.com. Scroll across the top, click on podcast, find Right Side Up, give a click, listen, maybe tell a friend if you enjoy it. Try to get a hold of us on rightsideupradio@gmail.com. Send us a comment if you like what you hear. Paul,
yeah.
How do our listeners find you?
Well, I would say one of my favorite places you could find me would be on X, or some people still call Twitter.
Okay.
My handle is PBeanVT, capital VT. You can find me on Instagram. My handle there is PBean802, I'm pretty sure. I respond, and you can look me up on Facebook. Look up Paul Bean on social media. Pretty sure I'll pop up. But if I don't, you can also reach out to look up ourgeoengineeringage.org. Check out ourgeoengineeringage.org. We have all our contact information there. We also have a weekly Substack with OGA, and that's something that I help produce. And we've definitely really been trying to grow the Substack and grow the social media. We have social media too, of course, for OGA. Look up Our Geoengineering Age on Facebook, and look up OGA_geoengineering on Instagram. Those are our two biggest pages, and that's where you can find us. I mean, we have 33 peer reviewed articles on geoengineering on our website. Actually, it might be 34 now. We have dozens of essays and some stuff written by me. We have, we have a real team at OGA. We have a nuclear geochemist. We have a medical doctor down in Florida, and two very devoted Vermonters that are both environmental historians. And, you know, these guys are much older than me, and they're absolute geniuses. I truly mean that in every sense of the word, genius.
Well, getting into the health issues, because we were talking a little bit before we started recording again, you were concerned about some of the things that they're putting into the atmosphere, or you suspect they're putting into the atmosphere, and what some of the health issues might be.
Yeah, well, so the big one that a lot of people have been talking about is Alzheimer's, and we're finding more and more studies proving that Alzheimer's is essentially caused by buildup of aluminum within the body.
Okay.
So that's one of the big ones. There's also some concerns about, you know, just like respiratory illness, period. You know, whether it's, COVID,
asthma.
Whether it's COVID-19 or it's...
So many kids have asthma these days.
Yes.
It's crazy.
Yeah, or whether it's asthma. That's the big one, too, respiratory illnesses. And, I mean, ultimately, I would make the argument that it's so bad for us. It's so toxic. It's, it's leading us down a path as humans that... I don't think we're quite prepared, or we really fully understand where we're going with this stuff.
And so the theory is that whatever they're putting into the atmosphere contains these metals.
Yeah, well, it contains aluminum, barium, strontium, sulfurs. There's some of that too. There's a list. I highly recommend too, if you get a chance, ourgeoengineeringage.org. We have real scientific studies. People that have gone out and tested the water, tested the soil. And tested this not just in Vermont, but in Florida, in California, in Spain, and they're finding similar findings. And it's that, that's the thing. Like, we're not claiming we know exactly what's going on, because we don't. And anyone who does, by the way, is probably lying, because they have an incentive to. Just like, I was talking about this David Keith, the Harvard professor / researcher who's saying, this is something we must do, and I know it's going to work. Anyone who's saying that has an economic reason. We don't know exactly what's going on. We just know that something's going on. And we basically make the argument that, there's chemicals being sprayed, and there's toxic metals being sprayed. For example, we believe coal fly ash is one of them. And so for people who don't know what coal fly ash is, it's what's left over after burning coal in coal-powered plants. So it's like the, real thin soot that's left.
The soot. It's
very, very fine black.
Very fine.
Dust.
Makes great condensation nuclei.
Well, that's the point, right? So some of us, we kind of make the argument. We have this concept of pump, dump, excuse me, pump, jump, and dump. Pump, jump, and dump. So your first pumping the atmosphere with CFAs, right? You're filling the skies, you know, through commercial jets or who knows, potentially private military, not private military, but military operations. And so you're pumping the sky full of chemicals. Then you're jumping them like a car battery, right? So when you have all these chemicals and metals and potential nuclei just sitting in the troposphere, which is where a lot of the geoengineering is done currently, they're jumping them with electromagnetic frequencies with ionospheric heaters. So ionospheric heaters, they change the temperature of these chemicals that are just sitting aloft in the upper atmosphere or lower atmosphere, the troposphere. And so when you're changing the temperature of the atmosphere, then you're manipulating the weather. And that's, you know, that there's another explanation I need to get into about that also. But, and then you have the dump, and the dump is, well, what goes into the sky is going to fall from the sky. So that's when you see, you know, sometimes you'll see people, they'll post pictures of the sky and they'll be like, what is this? And I expect rain in a couple of days. And then of course, in a couple of days later, you know, they post the picture of the sky. It looks like the trails behind the airplanes. Yeah. And then a few days later, it dumps rain.
Okay,
and
so, but you're not saying that every time you look up into the sky and see a contrail, that it's a chemtrail.
No, that's not fair.
Yeah.
And that's, it's actually ridiculous to say that because contrails are, you know, they're there. They've always been there, you know, and actually back in the during World War II, you know, there was a lot more condensation trails because the engines were not as efficient and they were actually emitting a lot. I don't know exactly what, but they were emitting a lot. I think it was a lot more water vapor. They were emitting a lot more water vapor.
They operated in lower altitudes, probably the mid-20,000s, okay. And there's more moisture there. Once you get up into the 30,000s, 35, 37,000, there's very, very little moisture present at those altitudes normally.
Okay.
So when a jet flies through, condensation, water vapor, is a normal reaction to an internal combustion engine.
Okay.
So when the engines, you know, fly through the sky, there's water vapor emitted and it forms a cloud. Essentially, it's a little cloud because there's no water vapor around it. And that's why you see them kind of dissipate depending on the humidity, the moisture that is there. They'll stay longer or they'll disappear very quickly. So it's all moisture dependent.
I guess what the argument that we make is that what you're seeing is not, a lot of the time, is not condensation trails because of how long it takes for them to dissipate.
Even up to
like, you know, 12 hours, 24 hours, you know, you're seeing the what looks like a milky, murky, just like haze. It almost looks like a computer screen. If it was like, you know, you're looking up at the sky and it's like
with contrails, before the plane you're looking at gets across the sky, you can see that the contrail is already dissipating.
I've never seen one last 8, 10, 12 hours, but...
Well, it won't sit there looking just like a contrail. No. It'll disperse.
But here again, it depends on the environment that the airplane operated in, what altitude it was, and the atmospheric conditions at the time, and how much moisture there actually was present. If the air is very, very dry, if there's no moisture at all, you could anticipate that contrail might dissipate rapidly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's absorbed in the atmosphere. But if conversely, if there's a substantial amount of moisture at that level that he's operating at, it may linger for a while.
Sure. Well, there is truth to that. And that's the thing. It's not one or the other, right? It's not both of these things can be true. And that's, I think, what we're seeing. I mean, I'm not one to say there's a lot of, you know, people out there. And this is what, if you've ever watched Guy Page and I talk about this on the Vermont Daily Chronicle show, you know, there's a lot of people out there who talk about this subject, which they don't really have a lot of information. They're a lot of the times kind of like the tinfoil hat type people, which you could have easily thrown me into that category. I mean, you still could probably. And they just like don't really have a clue what they're talking about. So they'll just go out and be like, oh, yeah, I mean, that's a chemtrail. Anything's a chemtrail. You know, and it's like that's just not.
Nah.
And even the phrase chemtrail, you know, that phrase, we at OGA try to avoid it simply because, you know, that phrase now is weaponized, right? I mean, if you look up chemtrail, the first thing that pops up is Wikipedia page calling the chemtrail the erroneous conspiracy theory. It's just so funny to us. But the truth is, the phrase chemtrail was actually coined by the United States Air Force. So, and that's in a textbook, I think it was a chemistry textbook in 1991. And we have that on OGA.org, our geoengineeringage.org. And we have that up there along with countless other proof and information.
The Air Force does do a lot of experimentation. I think they're the first ones that what was it? They've used a number of different biofuels rather than the normal jet fuel, and I think they're doing a lot of experimentation there. So it's entirely possible that they may have experimented with this stuff before, but commercial airliners, I was an airline pilot for 29 years,
yeah.
and as captain for half of that, I was pretty darn sure of everything that was on board that aircraft, yeah, that got loaded onto it or offloaded.
Sure.
And as an airline pilot, I've dumped fuel.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't call that making a chemtrail.
It was
jet fuel, thousands of gallons. And that does happen every once in a while. And I would not want to be anywhere around it. Typically, if that happens, we do it out over the water somewhere. But So we're not saying that everything in the sky.
It's not fair to say that.
Yeah. No.
It's just not. And to your point, too, I have a friend now. He works he's an airline pilot. He just started working with Southwest. And, he says same thing as you, but he also says, like, there's some days when I see it, like, it just seems so obvious to me that something else is going on. And maybe that's maybe kind of my point is, like, how long ago did you stop flying?
10 years.
Yeah. I would argue, and I think he would potentially argue this, and our organization would argue this, is really in the last 20 years, the geoengineering operations have been ramped up. And whether that's commercial airlines, I would argue, yes, I will say that on the record. I do believe that commercial airlines do have something to do with this. And I also do believe the military has a role to play. And I think that there are international bodies that have a role to play, too.
Well, I will certainly say that commercial airliners dump a lot of whatever,
yeah,
into the atmosphere. I was a flight engineer for a short period of time on a Boeing 747. And I'll never forget taxiing out of London Heathrow. It was a 10.5-hour nonstop flight to Los Angeles. And as a flight engineer, I was in charge of the fuel. And as we taxied out, I had 303,000 pounds of fuel on board. And when we landed in L.A., we were actually running a little bit short. We were down to 24,000 pounds. So 275,000 pounds went through those engines, four engines,
sure,
between Heathrow and L.A., and that's one airliner,
yeah,
one leg. So whatever the residue was that we were dumping, we dumped a hell of a lot of it.
And there's 100,000. I mean, there's hundreds of thousand flights every day. Hundreds,
I'm sure.
Of
yeah. Oh, absolutely. And that's what I'm saying. This was one trip, one leg.
Yeah. There's some people that argue too. Like there's another gentleman out there named Bill Lee. Not maybe I always mix him up now because there's Bill Lee. Bill Lee's the governor of Tennessee. Jim Lee, Bill Lee, the governor of Tennessee, signed into law banning geoengineering. But Jim Lee, he's also a geoengineering guy. Same kind of like really worried about it. And he makes the argument that it's actually just additives into the fuel. Whatever they're doing, it's just additives into the fuel. And also it's a result of of this actually kind of what you're talking about. A lot of the time, it's on accident that the commercial airlines are doing this. It's just a byproduct of condensation trails that would exist potentially anyway. We don't believe that at OGA, though. We argue that there's something a lot more nefarious going on. But that's just a little different,
Yeah. I want to bring up one little point. Like you said something about the coal fly ash.
Yeah.
Diesel fuels that are available at the pump these days are ultra low sulfur fuels. If they're pumping this stuff into the atmosphere, then people need to be aware of the double standard. We're paying more at the pump for diesel fuel, and anybody who goes to the grocery store is dealing with supermarkets that deal with trucking outfits that have to buy fuel. Well, You've got a double standard. I can't have sulfur in my diesel, but the governments can go and put this? No. It needs to.
Well, we're running out of time for this week, but Paul, thank you for coming to join us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
It's been extremely informative. And as always, stay safe, stay informed, listen to Right Side Up.